Welcome to the Booktopia podcast. I'm John Purcell. I'm sitting here with Olivia Crowley. And we're across from Jonathan Thurston, who's come and talk about his new book, his autobiography, JT. Welcome.
Yeah, thanks for having me.
Now, it's always interesting to see the reaction of Booktopians when we have a visitor. You, by far, have been the most sought-after photo here at Booktopia. It was like we had a line. It's crazy. And it's not hard to see why. You have been extraordinarily successful at the thing you chose to do. Like, it's been an incredible career. And for someone, right at the beginning, that people didn't just try and grab.
Like, yeah,
what was it like right at the beginning of your career when you've got this drive to do what you want to do?
Yeah,
and then you get to that point.
Yeah, so through my teenage years, it was quite tough. I always believed in myself that I was better than the players that were getting the scholarships with the Broncos and the shiny new tracksuits from the footy clubs, and I kept getting overlooked. But I think that made me more resilient and more determined to want me to succeed, and I would just really put the blinkers on, and no one got in my way of me trying to achieve my dreams, and I just kept persevering, and finally got that opportunity.
It's kind of my favourite story when these things happen. When someone who ends up being the winner of the awards, of grand finals, of test matches, is the one at the beginning who has such difficulty to get in. They won't let you in. It's just nuts. Is it? You think it's because you do things differently? Is it because you play the game in a different way that they just couldn't recognise that you were going to be good at it?
Yeah, I'm not too sure. From when I got a manager, the thing that he always was telling me, that scouts were always saying that I was too small and, I wouldn't make it. I just didn't have the right build. I couldn't tackle, all this type of stuff. So that was all crushing when you're 15, 16, 17 years of age. But I love rugby league so much, and like I said, there was nothing going to stop me from achieving my dreams, and I was just that determined to get a contract in the end, and once I did, I didn't look back.
I know, because it just went off. Like, you went off.
Yeah, I know. It happened so quickly for me. Once I got that opportunity at the Bulldogs, took me a while to play under 20s. It was called Jersey Flag then. Took me a good couple of months to crack the side, but once I'd gotten into the side, then it just happened very quickly. 4 or 5 games of Jersey Flag, and then I got chosen to sit on the bench for reserve grade, and then my first reserve grade game, I play in the centres and I end up playing 70-odd minutes, score a couple of tries, set a couple up and kick goals, and it just happened so quickly from there.
And you're also fairly unsure getting into the 2004 grand final, even whether you were going to play or not.
Yeah, that's right. So 2004 was a year that was a struggle. Injuries, and then in and out of first grade, and the final series came, and I played the last final game before the final series, and then I got dropped for the first game of the finals, and I thought my first grade career at the Bulldogs was over. And then
really?
I got picked to play in the second final. I played really well, scored a couple of tries, set a couple up, so I thought I'd stay back in the side. And then the next final, Foxy tells me that he's going with the bigger side, so I get dropped. So I'm thinking, well, that's my last game I've played for the Bulldogs. And then we win that game, and I have a pretty big couple of nights on the drink, because I think I'm not playing. Steve Price gets injured, so I'm just thinking that folks, you'll pick another forward. And he's called me into his office, and he said, I'm going to play you in the grand final. And I almost fell off my chair, because I had a couple of big nights on the drink as well. So I was like thinking, well, trying to remember, I didn't do anything wrong. What's he calling me in the office for? So, and then, once he told me I was playing in the grand final, I was like, damn, I haven't had the greatest preparation, but it starts now. And yeah, to be a part of that at 21 years of age is something I'll never forget.
Is there any point where you want to ring the Broncos and say, nah, nah?
There is at times, but the rivalry that we've had from the Cowboys and the Broncos, it's been huge, and I've got a lot of respect for the club. Obviously, a lot of good mates at the club as well, playing rep footy alongside those boys. So there's a lot of mutual respect there, but. As a Cowboys player, there's nothing better than beating the Broncos.
One of the things, I've watched many of your games, and you always seem to be, you never seem to be nervous, you always seem to be calm, keeping everyone in as a team. Do you get nervous in those times?
No. So, yeah, obviously the more experience you get, the players look towards you to calm the team down. And, you know, if I'm showing nerves and if I'm showing that I'm rattled during games, then that doesn't send a very good vibe to the rest of the playing group. So as a captain, I've been lucky enough to play under some really good captains, Steve Price, Darren Lockyer, another one, and obviously Cam Smith. And if you look at those three boys, you wouldn't know whether they're ahead by 10 points or they're behind by 10 points because they're always just nice and calm and collected. And that's something that I've tried to bring into my captaincy. When I play the game, I play it with my heart on the sleeve, so I'm very animated. But I've certainly tried to take that aspect from those qualities from those captains.
Do you think of yourself as an instinctive or a thinking kind of player? Because I always look at you and go, you're sizing everything up. I just want to know whether or not it's happening at the moment, or your experience is kind of giving you these hits. Because one of the things that if you're playing a team that I don't want you to beat, one of the things that's really terrible is when you're still on the field. There's always this feeling that you could do something and just crush my soul or something. At one moment I'm thinking, he's got this planned out. The next moment I'm thinking, that's just momentary genius. Bang, he's done it.
Yeah, so it's obviously a lot of preparation during the week, identifying the weaknesses of teams, and when you get into opportunities, making sure that you capitalise on them. And, as a ball player, you got to watch what the defenders are doing. You got to count numbers as well, so you can read whether you got an overlap on the long side or an overlap on the short side. So defensive structures are so great. They're so good these days that when you get an opportunity, you need to make the most of it because you don't get many. And, I've been able to, I suppose, our game plan, I've been really good at reading that and making sure that I can, come up with those game plans and execute those game plans as well. So I am instinctive, but I can also fall back onto the structures that the coaching staff have given us. And that's what I've really liked about playing for the Cowboys and the representative teams, where they give us structures, but they also let us play instinctively.
One of the sides you've had, across different teams, you've had quite a few different coaches and mentors. How important are they as you've moved through over the years and even becoming a mentor now, I guess, to a lot of the young guys?
Yeah, extremely important. I always looked up to Darren Lockyer through my teenage years, and to be able to, finally play alongside him was just like a dream come true for me. And, we're really good mates now. And, Mel Meninga was a hero of mine when I was growing up as a kid, playing in the backyard, and Alfie Langer and the like. So to have a personal relationship with them is something that I'm forever grateful for. And, those men that I've just mentioned, they've played a huge part in my life, not only on the field but off the field as well. There's been times where I felt I've been struggling football-wise, where I've been able to give them a call and speak to them about a couple of things. But especially with Mal, when I've had troubles with my life, I've been able to give him a call, and he's been a big mentor of mine over the years, and forever grateful for the relationship that I've got with him.
Because you've not only had the premiership winning success with Cowboys, but you've obliterated New South Wales time and time again. Yeah. Which, you know,
it's painful.
So being part, of that team and you know, year after year, just coming and just knocking New South Wales back across the border, just must be. Because I was wondering about success and what it does to someone at your level. Because I was thinking about Serena Williams and these kind of people who just keep. So you get Dally M, you get the premierships, you get called up to the Origin, you win the Origin, you've done the test, you win that, you get like this, and the 5-8 and the halfback awards. What drives you after you? They've piled all the medals and all the prizes on top of you that you can win. What gets you going the next day? Is it just always a new game?
Yeah, I think personally for myself, it's I always wanted to be the best that I can be on the field and certainly off the field. And, you know, my teammates is what motivates me, you know, not wanting to let them down. So, you know, I was very, the last probably 10, 12 years of my career, I started to learn that preparation was the key to success early on. For me, it was just more instinctively, more about training and things like that. But, you know, learning from Darren Lockyer, learning from Steve Price, Petro Sivanisiva and the likes that, you know, they really teach you about professional rugby league and how to play at the highest level. And, you know, for me, when Cameron Smith came into the Queensland side, he had guys like Matty Singh, Gordon Tellis, Darren Lockyer, all these types of blokes. And for New South Wales, before, you know, when I came in, they had the likes of Joey, Fittler, Denny Badiris. And once those blokes left, then who did the next generation of their team had to look up to? For me, I still had Lockie, Petro, Steve Price, Brad Thorne, Matty Singh, all these types of blokes that, you know, really instilled that Queensland culture into us. And then, you know, we've really passed that on to the next generation. And I think that's why we've had that success through that period. We had those players that were the best in those positions. And, yeah, it was certainly a hell of a ride.
Well, it sounds like part of the success is that handing on of information, like the mentoring. That link seems to be lost in the New South Wales side, but on your side, that mentoring, and it continues after they leave as well. Like, they're not gone from the Queensland side, even if they're not in it. They're still available for you and upcoming players to learn from.
That's right. So, you know, we've been very blessed at the Queensland level of the, you know, the type of players that we've had. And even though some of us have moved on, you know, Kevy and Mal before him would always get the past players in, and, you know, for players to make sure that they feel comfortable coming in. And we've got a great system, the Queensland system, where, you know, there's 18th, 19th, 20th men, so that they're on the brink of playing State of Origin, where they can come in and learn about the team environment. You know, they're part of the structures. They know what's going on and what's required of them. So when they come into the team, they're not foreign of what's expected of them.
Yeah.
One of the things, so you've spoken in this book that you've got out, is a lot around the family, your family, and getting them on side and helping you through lots of different challenges, not just football, but things happening outside of football. Yep. How critical is that for having family on board?
Yeah.
For everything,
yeah,
injuries?
Very, very. Obviously, you know, being my wife now, Samantha, she's been a big part of my life, and it's no secret that when I met her, you know, my footballing went to another level. You know, the structures she put around my life, you know, certainly helped me, you know, concentrate on football and being the best, you know, rugby league player I can be. But mum and dad were, you know, very big. You know, my brothers and my sister, having them around certainly helped. You know, whenever I played in Sydney, I'd always have my sister come and support me. I've got family in Melbourne, so whenever I played in Melbourne, they'd come and support me. Brisbane, you know, I'd have the biggest ticket order out of the team for family to come and watch me. So for me, family is very important, and certainly they help you get through the tough times as well. And, you know, I've had a fair few of those.
Yeah, yeah. When you describe in the book playing international football a few days after your uncle was killed, and that must have just been, I mean, in one sense, being able to do that for him is one way of respecting that relationship. But it must have been tough.
Yeah, it was extremely tough. You know, I remember sitting on the bus. We'd just finished training and we were about to pull up to the hotel, and Samantha, my wife, calls me and she asks, where are you? And I was like, I'm on the bus. We're just about to get off. And I could sort of feel something was wrong in her voice, and I said, what's the matter? And she said, last night your uncle Richard had been murdered in a park in Woodridge, and I just couldn't believe it. Like, I was like, what do you mean? And it just suddenly sort of hit me, and Lockie was sitting behind me and he could sense something wrong in my voice, and you know, he sat beside me and asked me, you know, what's wrong. And I've told him, and we went and had a chat to Ricky Stewart. And for me And for my family, I knew that the best thing for them would be to play that weekend. And through the horrific circumstances that the family had been through, I knew that this would, you know, put a smile on their faces. And I knew that Uncle Richard would be smiling down on me, wearing the green and gold, and, you know, to be able to go out and, I suppose I didn't realise how strong and how tough and how resilient I really was up until that point. And to be able to play a few days later after your uncle was murdered.
It's impressive.
Yeah, and, you know, I'm very proud I was able to do that and, you know, put a smile on my family's faces during a very difficult time.
And I'm thinking that trying to write about this, trying to talk about it, you know, the writing of a book is a long process, and you've been talking to James Phelps, who's written this with you, and we know James. He comes in, he writes a lot of stuff, and he's a good talker. But it is, I mean, you probably want to concentrate on your career, and James is going, how about some more of the personal stuff? And it's kind of prying thing to do, to write a memoir. How did you find the process?
So I was a little bit scared about it to begin with, but once Phelps had come up and spent a week with me, and after the first day I felt really comfortable alongside him, and I felt comfortable opening up my soul and my life to him. And, you know, the process was difficult at times, going back and reliving some of those memories that I've got, and especially what we were just talking about, that was quite difficult. And, you know, certainly in my childhood as well, which were fun times, but, you know, I was no angel. And reliving those, you know, I'm not proud of some of the things that I've done, but, you know, I hope it inspires, you know, kids around the country that, you know, if they are heading down the wrong path like I was, you know, that they can get on track and you know, become who they want to be and achieve what they want to achieve as well. So, while some parts of the book was difficult to write and relive, you know, James really made me feel comfortable, and, you know, I wanted to make sure that when we did it, I was open and honest, and, you know, I wanted to tell the true story of what has happened throughout my life. And, you know, I think we've done that in the book.
Yeah, well, I mean, the honesty is the key with these kind of books, because there are people out there who, you know, do great things and they sit down to write about it and they kind of control the story in a way that is, well, completely boring to the reader. but, you know, the honesty part is so important, but also the way in which a writer can reach out and bring you into a story. And I think the book does that. It's like you're having a chat with you.
Yeah,
and you're telling your story. It's great in that way. It's really close. Like it feels like this. Like when yeah.
I think when I was reading it through, there were whole sections that I was really laughing at. Having some of them, I'd seen the media side or seen the other side, and reading it, and you just go, "Oh, that's what was. Okay." And it's quite funny in hindsight and seeing the other side of the story.
Yeah. So yeah, you know, like I said, I was. You know, obviously knew James, you know, from my Bulldogs days. And so, you know, to sit down with him and, you know, like I said, I wanted to bear it all. I wanted to lay it out all out on the table. And, you know, after that first day, I felt extremely comfortable with James. And, you know, I think he's done a great job and, you know, bringing my story to life.
Yeah, well, it's already selling like hotcakes at the moment.
It's just,
yeah, it's really great. Thank you so much for coming in. Thank you so much for taking the time to come in. It's been wonderful meeting you, and it's been lovely having a chat. Thank you.
Thank you for having me. And yeah, I'm really excited about the book, and it was a fun process. So thanks for having me.
We have got a whole lot of other questions, but we're running out of time.
Oh, sorry.
Thank you so much.
No worries. Thanks. Yeah.
And Jonathan's book is available at booktopia.com.au right now.
Thanks for listening to the Booktopia podcast. Don't forget to subscribe to us on SoundCloud and iTunes. And if your eyeballs need a workout, check us out on YouTube at Booktopia TV. And don't forget, for all books featured on this episode and all episodes of the Booktopia podcast, head to Booktopia, Australia's local bookstore, at www.booktopia.com.au. Thanks for listening.